Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, families and friends across the country will gather around tables filled with food to give thanks. On today's Your Call, as we always do around this time of year, in addition to giving thanks, we want to recognize the true history of Thanksgiving. For many Native Americans, Thanksgiving is a national day of mourning. In fact, the United American Indians of New England are preparing to mark their 50th annual National Day of Mourning in the seaside town where the Pilgrims settled. Organizers hold this solemn event to remember the genocide of millions of Native people, the theft of lands, and the relentless assault on Native culture. Mahotuin Monroe, a co-leader of the group, told the Associated Press, quote, "We talk about the history because we must. The focus is always on the Pilgrims. More and more non-Native people have been listening to us. They're trying to adjust their prism." End quote. Well, today's guest, Professor David Silverman, tells the true history of Thanksgiving from the perspective of the Wampanoags. In his new book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving, he writes, quote, "Most of us who are not Wampanoag or American Indian will never fully grasp the raw emotions Indigenous people associate with Thanksgiving. Yet the nation can and should move towards such an understanding. Doing so will be a small step toward creating a more welcoming environment for Indians in the national culture of the United States after generations of hostility and indifference." David Silverman is a professor at George Washington University, where he specializes in Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history. He is the author of several books, including Thundersticks, Firearms and the Violent Transformation of Native America, and Red Brethren, The Brother Town and Stockbridge Indians and the Problem of Race in America. And again, his new book is called This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Hi, Professor Silverman. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I actually have a copy of Thundersticks, which I have not started yet, but it's on my list. So I was excited to see your name also on this book. And first, I'm wondering, you have written many, many books about Native history. When did you first become interested in this?
I think I first became interested in college when I had a first-rate professor in Native American history who awakened me to this incredible gap in my historical knowledge. And once I began putting Native people at the center of my historical perspective, it turned American history inside out for me and made it much more exciting. It also opened my perspective to corners of American society today that I was previously unaware of.
It must be interesting for you as someone who writes about Native history to watch and just see an explosion of activism, new books by Native authors, new documentaries, Standing Rock, the environmental indigenous groups. There's just so much activity happening right now.
That's right. Native people have passed through the apocalypse, as one might formulate it. They're here to stay. And, now that they've passed through that apocalypse and gotten their sea legs under them again, they're reasserting their sovereignty, their political sovereignty, their cultural sovereignty. And they're insisting, among other things, that we get their role in history correct. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book.
In 2005, you wrote a book about the Wampanoag people of Martha's Vineyard. And you've said that you were really interested in how that group managed to avoid violence with their colonial neighbors and survive to this day. And in the course of interacting with Wampanoag people, you say that what kept coming up over and over again was Thanksgiving and how the holiday was really difficult and how their children in particular felt so alienated by the wider culture. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. The main reason I wrote this current book is because of those very conversations. Native people, Wampanoag people in particular, to a person would talk to me about how hard this season was for them, and not only as adults, but particularly as children. And, you know, what they would say is that, you know, they'd be sitting there in class and, you know, their teachers, authority figures after all, would propagate this false history, this sugar-coated, sanitized myth of the first Thanksgiving in which Native people bloodlessly hand over their land and their sovereignty to colonists and then get out of the way so that the United States can emerge as a democratic beacon of religious freedom and Christianity for the rest of the world to model. What's more, that false history of this so-called first Thanksgiving was often accompanied by the teachers telling the students that the New England Indians were all gone, even as there were New England Indians sitting right in front of them. Mm. They would tell me stories about their parents coming in to protest these lessons, only to have school officials question their authenticity as Indians because they were modern people, because they drove cars and had jobs and shopped at the supermarket, wore modern clothing, and spoke English. They would tell me about how hard it was to drive by their neighbors' homes, decorated with images of happy Indians and pilgrims, and watching television programs that propagated the same message. And it seemed to me that I was in a position as a historian who had studied this history intensively to take their voices and bring them to the fore. And that's what I've tried to do.
You know, listening to you, Professor Silverman, you just reminded me, my grandmother on my dad's side was a Pomo, and she used to go speak to high school students about her mom, who was a well-known basket maker from Northern California. And she said that when she went into the classroom, this was grade school, the kids were shocked that she wasn't wearing moccasins, that she did not have feathers in her hair, and that she actually lived in a home with four walls rather than a teepee. I mean, this happened for years. They asked her the same questions.
I think one of the most pernicious stereotypes that American society imposes on Native people is this idea that they're relics of the past, that the only authentic Indians are supposed to be frozen in some kind of Stone Age existence, and that if they change with their times, as all people have to do in order to survive, they're somehow sacrificing their claims to be Indian. And that's a racial ideology that is designed to make Native people disappear so that white society can appropriate their lands. And it's a standard that American society imposes on no other group of people of whom I'm aware.
When the National Museum of the American Indian opened in Washington, D.C., there was a big billboard outside of the museum that said, "Do Indians really still live in teepees? Come in to find out." I mean, this was in Washington, D.C.
Right. And there's a lot of reasons for messaging like that. I think the main one is the influence of Hollywood over the course of the 20th century. Many Native critics will tell you that, their American society imposed all kinds of terrible burdens on indigenous people over the course of the 20th century. But none was greater than the stereotypes that were promoted by Hollywood. For most Americans, Native people weren't real. The only Native people that they encountered were on the silver screen. And, you know, those Natives were they all lived in teepees. They all had these grand feather headdresses and rode horses and hunted bison and terrorized wagon trains. And yet, as we know, that depiction of Plains Indians was quite inaccurate, and that depiction of Plains Indians can hardly stand for the vast diversity of Native America.
You have also spoken to a number of secondary school teachers, and they have told you that they feel ill-equipped to teach the truth about what happened because they don't have the knowledge to teach it. Talk about some of the conversations you've had with secondary school teachers.
Right. So these conversations are the other primary reason after my conversations with indigenous people for writing this book. Every summer, I participate in secondary school teacher training workshops at Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens. That's George Washington's ancestral estate. And what Mount Vernon does is it flies in junior high school and high school teachers and social studies from all around the country to bone up on their content knowledge. And I'm usually there to speak about indigenous people in the American Revolution. But when the teachers find out that I specialize in Native American history, what they all want to ask me about is the first Thanksgiving. And the reason is that all of them teach it, or at least they believe they're teaching it. In most cases, it's the only time in the American history curriculum that Native people feature prominently. And yet all these teachers will tell me that they feel totally underprepared to teach this history with any of the detail that it deserves, to place it in any of the rich context that it deserves. And so I wrote this book in no small degree for them, because these teachers reach nearly every child in our society. And if we're going to change our perspective on this historical subject, and for that matter, integrate indigenous people into our teaching of American history more generally, we have to begin with the teachers.
And let's talk just a little bit more about this, because it is so important. There are many efforts across the country to ensure that the truth does appear in the curriculum. But it really does take the teachers to take a stand. It also takes parents to take a stand. Because as you have said, most white Americans think the purpose of history education is to make young people feel patriotic. I mean, especially with this White House, it's all about patriotism, holding the flag, saying, this is my country. And when you teach the truth, as you have said, it really turns those patriotic themes on their head.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think the White House shoulders plenty of blame for a great many issues that we're struggling with at the moment. But, you know, let's be clear. This White House has a fervent constituency, numbering in the millions of people who feel the exact same way. Precisely as you've stated it here, a great many Americans believe the purpose of a history education is to foster patriotism, which necessarily means that we're asking instructors to distort the real history. As a professional historian, I believe that my job is to capture a complex history in all of its complexity. And I'm not particularly concerned with whether I upset the members of the descendant communities, white, Native, or any other, in the course of doing that. I think our job as instructors of history, is to teach our students to look back on the past critically so that they are better equipped to look at our present and future more critically.
Well, if any teachers are interested in bringing this book into the classroom, again, it's called This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. It's by today's guest, David Silverman, who's a professor at George Washington University. He specializes in Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history. He's got a number of other books about Native history if you're interested. You can find more about his work at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a child in school or if you have been in education, what are your thoughts about how Thanksgiving is taught in history class or just in school in general? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And the fact is, so many of us are really still learning about the true history of this country, especially Native history. There's so much more to learn. And luckily, we have time on the show to really spend an hour talking about it. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about the true history of Thanksgiving and what happened before 1620, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Professor Silverman, you did extensive research in this book. What was the process like, especially if, you know, some teachers are listening who might want to go do their own research to teach their students?
It's not easy to do this kind of research because the fact of the matter is that Native people didn't produce the vast bulk of the historical documents on which historians depend. I should be clear, they produced some of them. One of the remarkable aspects of Wampanoag history during the colonial era is that as the English began launching Christian missions to indigenous people, they established schools so that Native people could put their languages into alphabetic print and then could learn not only to write in their indigenous languages but read in their indigenous languages. And indeed, the first Bible printed in North America is in the Wampanoag language. And so, you know, in the course of that education, Wampanoag people began producing some of their own writings. But that's the exception to the rule. The vast majority of writings were produced by colonists, most of whom didn't have Native people's best intentions at heart, even when they thought they did, most of whom didn't know Native society and culture as well as they thought they did. And so, you know, colonists very often ignored entire sectors of Native society, like women and children and the elderly. And the male activities they focused on tended to be war, trade, and politics. Nevertheless, Native people had a knack during the colonial period, and the Wampanoag people in particular had a knack for getting their points across even when colonists didn't want to hear them. And one of the reasons they were able to do this is that colonial New England was not a single colony. It was made up of several different colonies, often with competing agendas. And so when Native people didn't feel like they were getting a fair hearing from one polity, they'd go to another to express their voices. What's more, even within particular colonies, there were different interest groups within English society – missionaries, traders, land speculators, politicians, and the like. And so playing these sources off of one another and reading between the lines very carefully can be a way of discerning Native priorities and perspectives. There's also the archaeological record, which, you know, is far from complete, but can tell us a great many things about Native material culture, health, social status, and the like. And not least of all, there are the descendant Wampanoags themselves, who have oral traditions and have their own culturally informed readings of the historical record that are invaluable in writing a book like this one.
In fact, if you go to Plymouth today, the Wampanoag tell their own story, right? There's a Wampanoag home site, as they call it, and it's actually run by Wampanoag staff who are basically telling visitors, we're here today and this is our history.
That's precisely right. And they have a different perspective on that history than non-Native people often do. And the most important point that they're making here is that we're not relics of the past, right? That we haven't disappeared. That this chapter in our history was not the final chapter. It was just one chapter in a long continuum that extends back thousands of years and will extend forward for many thousand more.
So let's talk about the Wampanoag communities. As you write, they had their own leaders. They could be male or female, and they were called, is it Sachem?
Sachem, yes.
Sachem. And Osumaquin was a Sachem. And I just really appreciate this book because so much of the history begins in 1620. But as you point out, Osumaquin, who was a Sachem, actually reached out to the English of Plymouth 100 years before the arrival of the Mayflower. This was from the 1520s onward. And this is something that hardly gets any attention unless you really dig for it.
Well, yes, his people had contact with Europeans for a century before the arrival of the Mayflower. That's a prologue to this historical episode that very few people are aware of. Right. The Wampanoags had been in contact with Europeans since at least 1524. That's the first documented contact. There could have been contacts before that went undocumented. And the pace of these contacts picked up considerably after 1602. So between 1602 and 1620, when the Mayflower arrives, these contacts are at least annual events, and sometimes there'd be several contacts each summer. They tended not to go well. Europeans had a tendency to overreact to native threats, real and imagined. Every time one of their tools went missing, they would respond violently to native people. And more to the point, Europeans had this penchant for capturing native people, taking them into captivity. Sometimes the point was to take them back to London for training as interpreters and guides for future voyages. At other times, the Europeans took these captives and sold them into overseas slavery. And so by the time the Mayflower arrives, the Wampanoags have developed quite an ill opinion of these overseas raiders and are ready to respond violently to any of their attempts to land in Wampanoag territory. Usamequin, when he decided to reach out to the English of Plymouth, did so over a great deal of Wampanoag opposition, in no small degree because of that history with Europeans.
So the Wampanoags were regularly attacked by European explorers from the 1520s onward?
That's correct. European slave raiding against along the coast was a common occurrence, and I think it will come as some surprise to most of your listeners that throughout the 16th, 17th, and into the early 18th century, it was just as common to encounter indigenous slaves in the colonies, and for that matter, in some European cities, as it was to encounter African slaves. Our best estimates nowadays for the Western Hemisphere is somewhere between 3 and 5 million indigenous people suffered slavery under European rule during the colonial period. And if we take that high number of 5 million, that's about 40% of the total volume of the transatlantic African slave trade. So this was not a rare exception to the rule of African slavery in the colonies. That trend changed dramatically in the 18th century when Europeans shifted primarily to African slavery. But it's an important feature of American history in general and to the history of the first Thanksgiving in particular.
And something that does not get much attention, I mean, not to take away from African slavery, because I'm so glad that there's such rich conversations happening now about that and about reparations, but we don't talk about Native Indian, indigenous slavery, whatever you want to call it. So what else can you tell us about indigenous people who were enslaved? How were they treated? I mean, how long did this last? What else can you tell us?
Well, most of them are lost to history because once they're sold into overseas dominions, we lose track of them in the historical record. But two figures in this history managed remarkably to free themselves and return back to Wampanoag country. One of them is barely known to anyone but historians. His name was Ipanau. He was a Wampanoag of Martha's Vineyard. He lived in London for 3 years in English captivity and got the English to bring him back home by promising to lead them to the gold reserves on his home island of Martha's Vineyard. I know you're in the Bay Area, and probably most of your listeners have never been to Martha's Vineyard. You'll have to trust me, there's no gold on Martha's Vineyard. He had learned what made his captors tick and manipulated that knowledge to get himself back home. The other figure who managed to return home is probably better known to your listeners. They probably know him by his name, Squanto. His Wampanoag, full Wampanoag name was Tisquantum, and he had suffered 5 years of captivity among the English. Indeed, initially the English sold him into slavery in Spain, but some Spanish friars freed him. He managed to work his way into the English merchant community of Malaga, Spain, and then through them make his way to London and then ultimately back to Wampanoag country. In the Thanksgiving myth that is so commonly well known, you know, Squanto is the interpreter and cultural ambassador between the Wampanoags and the English. The myth never pauses to explain how Tisquantum or Squanto managed to learn English in the first place. The answer is that he had been a slave. He had been a captive of the English, and that's how he acquired his English language skills.
Wow. Let's hear from David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. I read with great interest the review of your book in the recent issue of The New Yorker, and I was wondering, first of all, what you thought of that review and if the reviewer basically got their facts right. I'm also particularly interested because I have one of my best friends who is a member, whose family is a member of the Tataviam tribe that populated the San Fernando Valley. And still exists, and they're trying to get federal recognition. I was wondering if you had any knowledge about what the state of the Tataviam in Southern California was at the time of the Thanksgiving. And last, I'd be very curious to know, the review referenced that the Wampanoag were predisposed to enter into a mutual defense pact with the Europeans because they had experienced a severe epidemic that wiped out a significant portion of their population, but the review did not mention what the epidemic was and whether that was related to the European settlers. Thanks very much, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, David. Professor Silverman, did you read the review in The New Yorker by Philip DeLoria?
Oh, I certainly did, and I was grateful for it. I thought he did a great job of capturing the themes of the book. He's a colleague whom I respect enormously. As for the Tataviam case, I mean, look, in 1620, they were sovereign. And I think that's the most important point to emphasize for indigenous people all across the continent, that they were the first people, that they have had and have an inherent sovereignty. You know, in the case of California, some of you might be familiar with Benjamin Madley's book, American Genocide. You know, we are now, as academics, taking seriously the question of whether we should be applying the word genocide to white people's violent dispossession and subjugation of indigenous peoples, in particular times and places across the continent. California is, I think, the most powerful case study of where that word applies. And it's a historical question that I think all Californians need to reckon with.
Right.
In terms of the epidemic disease that afflicted the Wampanoags before the arrival of the Mayflower and that influenced Usamequin, the sachem or chief Usamequin's decision to reach out to the Pilgrims, despite the opposition of many Wampanoags who associated Europeans with that century of violent contact, we don't know what the epidemic was. There were a number of European ships active along the coast between the years 1616 and 1619 when that epidemic raged, and they called it generally a plague. They didn't mean the plague, as in the bubonic plague. They just, when they said plague, they meant it was a terrible disease. We don't know what it was. It could have been one of any number of European urban diseases. My bet is that it was smallpox, but I can't say for sure. What we do know is this. This disease devastated native people from the Saco River of Maine in the north all the way to the east bank of Narragansett Bay in the south. And it passed between indigenous peoples who were in close contact with one another because of intermarriage and trade and politics and the like. And the Wampanoags were one of those groups. It did not spread to the west side of Narragansett Bay, where the Narragansett tribe lived, which is probably a sign that the Wampanoags and the Narragansetts were not on good terms. We don't know precisely how many Wampanoags died. It could have been a majority of them, and I suspect it was. We know that this disease totally destroyed some villages. Indeed, when Squanto or Tisquantum comes back from his years of English captivity in 1619, just months before the arrival of the Mayflower, he returns to his home village of Patuxet, and everyone is gone. And that's the precise spot where the English decide to found Plymouth. Usamequin is leading the Wampanoags in the wake of this incredible disaster, and he's facing some significant challenges. The foremost among them was that the Narragansetts, again, who had not suffered this disease, were raiding the weakened Wampanoags in the hope of reducing them to the status of tributaries. In other words, making the Wampanoags subjugated to Narragansett authority. Usamequin saw in Plymouth Colony an opportunity to forge a military alliance with these newcomers and to acquire their metal weapons and particularly firearms with an eye towards fending off his Narragansett intertribal rivals. You know, so this epidemic disease is what accounts for Usamequin's outreach to the English. The Thanksgiving myth would have us believe that these native people were just friendly. No, they were not just friendly. They were responding to a dynamic and troubling diplomatic situation on the ground born of that terrible epidemic.
And at this time, the English were having a really difficult time, right? They were facing starvation. Do we know how many English were there at this time and how many Wampanoag were there?
Right. So the numbers weren't equitable at all. You know, there are about 102 passengers on the Mayflower, and within 3.5 months, half of them had died of disease and exposure. So things weren't going particularly well for them in March of 1621 when Usamequin finally decided to make contact with them. The Wampanoags, despite having been devastated by this epidemic of 1616 to 1619, outnumbered Plymouth Colony probably by a factor of 20 or more. The Wampanoags were easily the superior power here.
And it's also to point out that the English were not even heading for New England in the first place, right?
That's correct. They were heading for the Hudson River to the south, where New York City is located. But they couldn't get around the ship-eating shoals of the outer Cape Cod, and just decided to stay where they were. They were also happy to some degree to make a landing spot in that particular locale because it fell outside of the chartered bounds of any colonial company, which meant that they could pursue their rather eccentric religious practices without any interference from authorities in London.
What were those eccentric practices?
Well, these people we call pilgrims were separatists, and we call them separatists because they felt like the Anglican Church, the Church of England, of which the king was the head, was so morally bankrupt that anyone who affiliated with it had a ticket straight to hell. Separating from the king's church is really not the best way to put oneself in the good graces of state authorities.
Now, when the Wampanoag made this pact with the English, you write about how the Wampanoag taught the English really how to survive. They taught them how to plant crops because obviously the English did not plant maize. They taught them how to raise crops, where to fish, how to harvest shellfish. I mean, these were mostly tailors, right? So they had no knowledge about how to interact with the land.
No, they were utterly ill-equipped. You know, the history of 16th century North America, so, you know, the 1500s, and then the first decade of the 17th century, so the 1600s, they're littered with failed European colonies. lost colonies and colonies that went bankrupt or that native people drove out. Even Jamestown, the first permanent English colony in North America, came within inches of dissolving several times. And Plymouth almost became another addition to that list. You know, the way these people were planning to survive in North America was through trade with indigenous people. The one thing they knew that would turn a profit was trading with indigenous people for beaver pelts. Fundamentally, Plymouth Colony was not designed to be an agricultural venture. It was a financial venture backed by investors in London who wanted a return on their investment. So, you know, their expectation was that these colonists would secure an alliance with native people right away, trade with native people for food, and trade with native people for furs. The problem for the Plymouth colonists during the first few months is that the Wampanoags kept their distance. They didn't know who these people were, and they knew that Europeans had a really long track record of committing horrific violence against their people. And so the English needed the Wampanoags to feed them, to trade them furs, and for that matter, to protect them from other native people who wanted to eliminate the colony before it became a threat.
So if the Wampanoag people hadn't agreed to teach the English how to plant crops and basically survive, would they have been wiped out?
They wouldn't have made it several more months.
Right. But instead, in 1621, the English felt secure enough and they said, we're going to make it through another winter, so let's have a celebration.
Right. By the time we get to – so, you know, the low point for the colony is in March of 1621. Again, half the people have died. There's been no contact with indigenous people. The English don't know what crops they're going to plant. They haven't established a fur trade. Usamequin reaches out to them in March of 1621. The two peoples establish an uneasy alliance. And in late fall of that year, the English bring in their first successful crop. And let's be clear about what that crop was. It was Indian maize, right? It's a native crop that they're cultivating there using native techniques taught to them by the Wampanoag people. And so when one gets to late October, early November of 1621, the English feel that they can breathe easy for the first time and that maybe it's time to let down their guard a little bit, let down their hair, and celebrate a bit. And so that's what they decide to do. They decide to hold a harvest feast. They didn't believe that this feast was a Thanksgiving. The English already had a tradition of Thanksgivings, and it didn't involve gluttony and sport. It involved fasting, going to church all day, reflecting on the mercies of God. That's not what this event was.
The English started firing off guns, and the Wampanoags heard the gunfire and thought that the colony was under attack. And so Usamequin shows up with a large group of people. What happened after that?
Right. So I think part of the Thanksgiving myth is this notion that the English invited the Wampanoags to dinner. That's not what happened. Keep in mind, these two people have a mutual defense pact. The English, you know, as part of their celebration, begin firing off guns, you know, target practice and militia drills and the like. Well, the Wampanoags, as Wampanoag tradition today would have it, hear these guns and believe that the colony was under attack, either from the French, who were active along the coast, or the Narragansetts, who were enemies of the colony. And so Usamequin and 90 armed men rushed to the colony. Now, keep in mind that those 90 armed Wampanoags outnumbered the entire population of Plymouth, which included women, children, and the elderly, by a significant factor. And so, as one might expect, the English were quite startled by the appearance of this force. In almost any other colonial setting, an encounter of this sort would have produced incredible bloodshed, but enough trust had been fostered between the two parties at this particular moment that they laid down their arms and ultimately the English decided to ask the Wampanoags to stay, which they did for the next few days, and they contributed venison to the colonists' feast. And that was about the extent of it. You know, the English didn't think this was a particularly important event in the alliance. They dedicated only 4 lines of writing to it and never invoked it again in their diplomacy with the Wampanoags. The Wampanoags, for their part, never mentioned it in their diplomacy with the English. It's only later generations of Americans that have placed such importance on this shared dinner between peoples.
I mean, Professor Silverman, when you get into the real history, it's just completely the opposite of what we are taught. Can you remind us, how did Thanksgiving become a national holiday? And, you know, how did this story come about? I watched one of the talks you gave, and there's all these photos that we've all seen where the native and the white man are sitting there, and it looks like they're kind of just sharing some food and everyone's happy and getting along. So remind us where that story came from.
Well, it didn't come from the history. Very few Americans have asked the question, you know, what happened after dessert was served? And, you know, the fact of the matter is that this alliance was rife with tension. The typical myth emphasizes, well, there was 50 years of peace between the Wampanoags and the English after this so-called first Thanksgiving. Well, in a very narrow sense, that's true. But war scares were a constant feature of their relationship. And ultimately, the two peoples did go to war in the terrible King Philip's War of 1675-76, one of the bloodiest conflicts between native people and colonists in all of colonial history. The Thanksgiving myth pays no attention to that history. In terms of, you know, how this myth was generated, I think it will come as some surprise to your listeners that English colonists in New England didn't associate Thanksgiving with pilgrims and Indians throughout the 1600s, throughout the 1700s, and white Americans didn't make that association during the early decades of the 1800s. It's only in the 1840s that the Reverend Alexander Young published a series of primary source historical documents produced by the Pilgrims of Plymouth, which included those 4 lines relating to that shared feast between the English and the Wampanoags. And to that account, the Reverend Young added a footnote in which he said, "This was the first Thanksgiving, the great harvest festival of New England." Now, there aren't many, trust me as a historian, there aren't many famous footnotes in history. This is one of them. This primary source account was widely read. New England politicians and lecturers and authors disseminated the idea over the next several decades, so that when the President Abraham Lincoln declared Thanksgiving to be a national holiday in 1863, white Americans were prepared to accept that it was a holiday that originated in Plymouth in 1621. In terms of why white Americans were ready for this myth at that particular time, that's I think a very interesting question. One reason is that white Protestants, particularly in the Northeast, were growing increasingly alarmed at the influx of Catholic immigrants from Southern Europe. They were startled by the influx of Asian immigrants to the West Coast, and eventually by Jewish and Eastern Orthodox Christian immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. And so holding up the Pilgrims as founding fathers was a way for white Protestants in the Northeast to assert their ancestors as the founders of American values like religious freedom, democracy, and Christianity. The myth also took hold when it did because of racial tensions in the country and the desire of many white Protestants to distance themselves from what they called the era's Indian and black problems. This myth could not have taken hold at the time when the United States wars with the Indians of the Great Plains and the Far West were raging. It's only after their subjugation that Native people could be incorporated into a national founding myth. New Englanders also wanted to hold up their region as an exception to the national trends of Indian wars, racial slavery, which were still resonant during the era of Reconstruction after the Civil War. So they created this sanitized narrative about pilgrims and Indians and held it up as the colonial rule, when in fact that was a misrepresentation of that actual history and certainly didn't stand for colonial history, which was characterized by Indian wars and racial slavery.
And Professor Silverman, we're almost out of time, but one other thing, and then we're going to take a caller. I think this is just so important. You write that after they agreed to that pact, the Wampanoag expected the English to buy into their society. So basically they said, yes, you can build houses on this land, our land. Of course, they didn't see it like a capitalist or the English would in terms of owning the land. And their expectation was that the English would accede to the Wampanoag rules and authority, not that they would try to subjugate Wampanoag people to English law. Can you just briefly talk about that, especially when we're talking about the land and the English thinking that they owned it?
Right. So, the English did purchase Wampanoag land. They didn't just conquer it, though they certainly did that as well. When the English bought land, their assumption was, seeing themselves as civilized people and Christian people superior to savage pagans, which is how they characterize Native people, they assumed that that land passed out of Wampanoag jurisdiction into English jurisdiction, and that the English now had exclusive title to it, to the exclusion of Wampanoags. Well, Wampanoags didn't make that assumption at all. What they thought the English were doing when they were buying land was that they were buying into Wampanoag society, and that purchase obligated the English to engage in mutual hospitality and alliance with Wampanoag people, and that the English would follow Wampanoag rules. Indeed, sometimes the Wampanoags expressed their expectation that the English would have to pay tribute, or in other words, taxes, to Wampanoag leaders as part of their obligation living on the land. So, the two assumptions could not have been more different.
Right. Well, let's hear from one last caller. Let's go to Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. From 1520 to 1620, how, where, and under what circumstances was the Wampanoag encountering Englishmen, and what were the Englishmen doing, just roaming around or slave raiding, or what were they doing?
Right. The Wampanoag's encounters were not just with the English. They were also with the French, the Dutch, sometimes the Portuguese. Europeans are doing a lot of things along the coast. Part of what they're doing is just exploring. Europeans were insistent that there was a waterway between the Atlantic and the Pacific cutting through North America that they called the Northwest Passage. And that it's a mythical waterway, but, that didn't stop Europeans from believing in it. And so they're charting the coast, trying to figure out where that Northwest Passage might lie. They were searching for anything that would produce wealth for them. Let's keep in mind, Spanish explorations in Central and South America had exposed them to the gold and silver-laden Aztec and Inca peoples. And so there was every reasonable expectation on the part of Europeans that if they just explored the next bay, they just explored the next riverway, if they just pushed over the next mountain range, there might be another Native American empire laden with precious metals and minerals for Europeans to exploit. They're interested in trading with Native people for furs, which were a pathway to wealth in Europe. So there's all sorts of motivations for Europeans to explore this region. As I mentioned earlier, some Europeans are seizing Native people as slaves to sell in Europe and eventually into the West Indies. So there's a lot of motivations at work here.
Professor, before we have to end the show, what are you hearing from educators now that there's, your book is out? You have many books about Native issues. A number of Native people are writing books. There's documentaries. I mean, we're in a time with so much information.
Teachers commonly tell me that they are fully aware that they neglect Native American history within a greater American history, and that in so doing, they're doing a disservice to their students. During the colonial period that I study, Native people are the vast population majority in the continent. And let's be clear, Native people controlled most of North America well into the 1800s. But the history curriculum at the secondary level very rarely reflects that that reality. The problem is that most teachers feel handicapped both by their lack of content knowledge, but I think more importantly, by state-mandated curriculums from teaching this kind of material. If we want to empower teachers to do justice to Native American history, and I think there's every reason why we should, both from the perspective of justice and from the perspective of historical accuracy, we need to make teachers accountable for that material in what we're testing their students on. And that's going to require state boards of education to change their standards to reflect this history.
David Silverman is professor at George Washington University, where he specializes in Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history. His new book is This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. Professor Silverman, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Show McPullen for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.